Okay. Financial law, that's probably what we're doing. Can we go back to page 52, please? Now, I know it's upset some of us when I keep hopping about in the handout, but I'm not doing it just for fun. We finally had a decision in this case, which is why I keep hopping about, so we could save this till the end. The Office of Fair Trading and Abbey National PLC, speaking of the news. This is the case about bank charges, which has nothing gone along with me. And whether you've got to pay them or whether you can get it all back and all that kind of stuff. In the textbook, obviously, I got as far as the Court of Appeal. That was all that had been decided when the book was written. Unfortunately, the book was published after all this had been argued, so that all was a bit unfortunate. The banks won, and of course they won. If you read the legislation, there was no way they weren't going to win, frankly. The Court of Appeal's decision was specious, I think. They came to the right result, but the arguing was just all over the place. So what we're going to do is go through the unfair contract terms legislation simply to get us to what was going on in this case. This has become a bit of not a damp squib, but just a dead one by this stage. What we're discussing, and we'll discuss again in much more detail when we talk about banking regulation specifically, is how banks go about charging the likes of you and I, our customers, and whether or not their bank charges are unfair, and what we might think we can do about that. Okay. So not entirely surprisingly, one of the ways in which customers have argued this kind of thing is on the basis of the unfair contract terms legislation. Because that sounds like the kind of thing you're after, isn't it? If you think it's unfair, then that's probably the kind of thing. They're coming to get me already. The point is this, if you recall. The Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977 and then the various sets of regulations that come into effect after that are really concerned with trying to protect consumers. They are concerned with, particularly, with people using their standard contract terms when that person's in business and their counterparty isn't. Okay. So far, so good. So on your handout, on page 52, you've got section 2 of the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977. In the case of other loss or damage, which is not liability for death or personal injury resulting from negligence, a person cannot so exclude or restrict his liability for negligence except insofar as the term or notice satisfies the requirements of reasonableness. And it goes on in section 3. This section applies as between contracting parties where one of them deals as a consumer or on the other's written standard terms of business. It's all about disparity in bargaining power. Yeah, one of you is in business, one of you, for example, is a bank, and the other one a customer. As against that party, the other cannot, by reference to any contract term, when himself in breach of contract, exclude or restrict any liability of his in respect of the breach, or B, claim to be entitled to render contractual performance substantially different from that which is reasonably expected of him, or in respect of the whole or any part of his contractual obligation, to render no performance at all, except insofar as, in any of the cases mentioned above in this subsection, the contract term satisfies the requirement of reasonableness. Section 11 is that the term shall have been a fair and reasonable one to be included, having regard to the circumstances which were or reasonably to have been known to or in the contemplation of the parties when the contract was made. So the Act itself deals with exclusion clauses where the one who's in business, basically, for our purposes, let's say where the bank is seeking to exclude its liability under its own standard terms. So what I've been focusing on in the lectures hitherto, particularly when we talk about master agreements, was agreements primarily between market counterparties, or at least between people who are financial institutions. So when we talked about bankers' trust and Gavala, we looked at two things that were held to be ultimately by Mr. Justice Mance, financial institutions, even if one was more expert than the other. Now we're moving into that kind of consumer bit. Okay, so this is also probably going to talk about consumers for a little while until we get into banking regulation proper at the end of the course. So what you can't do is rely on an exclusion clause if it's your standard terms and you're the one that's in business. That's nice and straightforward. And that's not what's going on in the case we've got here, but I'll come back to all that in a second. And then Lord Griffith sets out in Smith and Eric Bush the sorts of criteria which we should take into account, the level of imbalance in the parties' negotiating standpoints, so whether they're of equal bargaining strength or not, whether it's reasonable to have contracted in a different way. Thirdly, whether there's anything specifically, particularly difficult about providing the service in question in the circumstances. If this is a standard banking business, then probably not. And fourthly, the ramifications of finding the exclusion clause can't be relied upon. Okay. So presumably you've done all this kind of stuff into contract law, exclusion of liability and UCTA. Thank you. Someone prepared to talk to me, no one else prepared to. Jolly good. Have a first talk to me. So that's where you're trying to exclude your liability, okay? Not what we're concerned about here. The FSA handbook restricts exclusion of liability more generally. So anything that is regulated by the FSA, anything falling under Section 19 by virtue of the schedules and is covered by this. So the FSA Conduct of Business Sourcebook, page 52 at the bottom there, a firm must not in any communication, so that's a contract or anything at all, relating to designated investment business, so in relation to something that falls under FSBA, may not seek to exclude or restrict or rely on any exclusion or restriction of any duty or liability it may have to a client under the regulatory system. So that, I would suggest, is an important part of contracts as they're formed under conduct of business regulation. You can't exclude your liability. We've mentioned that before. So that's an important part of ordinary contract law. It's a very important part of contract law as it applies to finance. And there's then, over the page, top of page 53, there's a guide to explain how the FSA thinks unfair contract terms will work in its particular context, UNFCOG, which just builds on exactly that same idea. Now, all the litigation that we're concerned with today grows out of the various regulations which have come out in the wake of the Unfair Contract Terms Act. Now, did you do the regulations? There's the page 53. There's the Unfair Terms and Consumer Contracts Regulations of 1994, and for our purposes, particularly important today, Unfair Terms in Consumer Contract Regulations 1999. Does this all sound familiar from contract law? Some shaking heads. Penelope? No one can remember. All right then. Really good. All right. So building off UCTA, these regulations have broadened out from being just UCTA concerned with exclusion clauses. This is concerned with contractual provisions more generally. This is all built on EU legislation and whether or not it's possible to basically set aside provisions on the basis they appear to be unfair. So in Director General of Fair Trading against First National Bank, cited by the House of Lords back in 2001, it was alleged against First National Bank that for the bank to rely on its standard terms would simply be unfair. The particular provision here was a provision that the customer would not only be required to pay interest, secondly, would not only be required to pay interest after a judgment that the customer had to pay up if they hadn't done so yet, but also that the customer be required to pay interest on that judgment after the date of judgment, until payment was finally made. And it was said, well, that's unfair, that last third bit. Yeah? Maybe we owe you money under the contract, maybe we've got to pay interest between our breach and at the time of judgment, but surely it's too much for you to charge interest after the date of judgment. Surely the court should settle the final amount. It was held that while theoretically that might fall under the Unfair Terms and Consumer Contracts Regulations 1994, it wasn't unfair. The House of Lords thought this is part of the party's bargain between them. There's nothing unfair about that per se. And that we shouldn't try the second thing and interpret these regulations too broadly. Which brings us to the current spat. Because what this current case, and we're talking about the Office of Fair Trading and Abbey National PLC, so on the handout under heading 5.4, You've got one case, Office for Fair Trade against Abbey National in 2008, 875. Then you get first instance in what we're concerned with, Office of Fair Trading and Abbey National, 2325. The Court of Appeals decision is Office of Fair Trading as Abbey National PLC, 2009, UK Civ. Yeah? England and Wales Court of Appeals, Civil Division, 116. And then this is the House of Lords, which came out yesterday. We have to look at these regulations to explain what's going on, but let me just explain to you in a nutshell what's happened. Okay? The regulations say, in effect, something can be set aside on the basis of its being unfair, I paraphrase, if it's not part of the party's main agreement. So this becomes the pivotal point. Because the theory being, when the legislation was put through at European level, if something is part of the party's main agreement, that's the kind of thing we expect they will have discussed between them. Yes? And so any terms that are part of their main agreement are things that presumably they've agreed to. This is all about freedom of contract ultimately, so if they've agreed to it, they should be bound by it. It's only things which are tangential, collateral, to one side, again I paraphrase, that the parties may not have thought about them, and therefore they're to be interpreted differently. So it's all a bit backwards, Regulation 6. It's all a bit backwards. What's being said in the Court of Appeal is that we can decide that these terms are unfair when banks decide to start charging you late in, you know, interest, when you go overdrawn and you write a cheque and they charge you for that. These kind of bank charges. The argument the Court of Appeal takes is, well, ordinary people wouldn't think about that kind of stuff. So it's not part of the main agreement. So it's something that we can look to and decide whether or not it's fair. The House of Lords have said, no, this is all part of the main agreement. Yeah, this is what the bank is charging you for offering you this service. It is part of the main agreement. And that's basically the only difference. It's an incredibly narrow legal point. We'll have a look at the regulations now. It's an incredibly narrow legal point. The way in which it's been treated in the press is as though this is a kind of a Hutton inquiry into bank charges. You know, the Supreme Court, because this is one of their first big decisions, that's actually, I think, it's their fifth decision according to their website. This is one of their first big decisions where we hope they're going to weigh in and say, we hate bankers too, their charges are unjust, let's hang them all. Yeah? That's basically what the press was expecting. If you looked at all the stuff that was in the papers over the week leading up to this judgment, that's what they've been saying. It's expected the Supreme Court will, you know, bash the banks, and what will happen next, and will this be the end of free banking? What the House of Lords did was just to sit and look at the regulations and say, well, of course this is part of the main agreement. This is the core of the bank's business. So if you just have a look at what the regulations say, as far as the court is concerned, and they do say at the beginning of the speeches, you know, Lord Walker in particular, I know everyone is watching this and everyone thinks this is a big deal, this is where we're going to bash banks. That's not actually, this is a very narrow point of law. So Regulation 5 of the Unfair Terms in Consumer Contract Regulations 1999 provides, a contractual term which has not been individually negotiated shall be regarded as unfair if, contrary to the requirement of good faith, it causes a significant imbalance in the party's rights and obligations arising under the contract to the detriment of the consumer. Okay, so something can be regarded as unfair if it causes a significant imbalance in the party's rights. So again, we're talking about, you know, big bank and little customer. And if it acts to the detriment of the consumer. So Regulation 6 becomes key. Insofar as it is in plain, intelligible language. So it's got to be plain, intelligible language. Hence get given those little shiny brochures by banks that are written as though for three-year-olds. Yeah. They're just trying to make it plain, intelligible language. The assessment of fairness, so deciding whether something is fair or unfair, of a term shall not relate to the definition of the main subject matter of the contract. So something is part of the main matter of the contract, you can't rule it unfair. Yeah? And so far as it's in plain intelligible language, the assessment of fairness of a term shall not relate to the definition of the main subject matter of the contract or to the adequacy of the price or remuneration as against the goods or services supplied in exchange. And the second bit, I think, really, is basically saying we're not going to inquire into whether consideration is adequate, as long as it's real, in effect. So, what's held by the Court of Appeal, as on the handout there, 2009 UKCIV 116, is that, and this is the case that's discussed in the text book, basically, poor little customer, this is Sir Anthony Clarke, Master of the Rolls, poor little customer isn't going to think about these kind of things. Yes? In effect, we're all a bit thick. It's surprising we can get out of bed in the morning and get our trousers on to get to the bank to sign a contract and open a bank account, let alone know what the bank account involves, is basically his approach. He says, it seems unlikely in the extreme that the typical customer reads the lengthy express terms and conditions in a contract. It seems unlikely in the extreme. I mean, it is true that often, I always find this with banks, they never actually give you the terms and conditions. They give you a brochure, they give you a leaflet, and then you say, can I have the terms and conditions, please? And they look at you, and they prod at the leaflet they've given you, and I say, no, proper terms and conditions, I am an adult. Yes? Look at age in face. And they wonder quite what's the matter with me. Obviously, you would. It's quite difficult, actually, to get the terms and conditions, but, you know, the assumption is, that Anthony Clarke is making, is that, you know, no one thinks about that kind of stuff. We all just rush willy-nilly into the bank and whatever else. And what do you think? Are you aware that you're going to get charged? I mean, not if you're on student accounts, so maybe this doesn't happen. Where are you going to get charged if you write a cheque and you're overdrawn already and you haven't got funds? I think most people know that. And certainly the leaflets always say it. Anyway, so Anthony Clarke's assumption, there's no evidence for this. There's no evidence adduced in front of him, you know, no economist has gone out and counted this, no sociologist has gone and even, you know, taken a clipboard and petitioned people in Lloyds and asked them, what do you reckon? Did you know? No, I thought this was Griggs the baker, I'm quite surprised there are no donuts. I'm such a moron. So he just assumes all of this. And what this means is, if customers don't know about this kind of stuff and they're not thinking about this stuff, the Court of Appeal can therefore conclude none of this stuff is part of the main bit of the contract. Yeah, about the charges you'll pay if you're overdrawn and you write a cheque and all that kind of stuff. And therefore, because it's not part of the main contract, the court is entitled to judge whether it's an unfair term or not. And therefore, the Court of Appeal was able to say, these are incredibly high charges, these swines, how dare they? This is really important to the banks. And in 2006, they reckoned the banks collectively, all the high street banks, to have earned £2.56 billion simply out of bank charges. The best customer a bank has is not one that pays. Now, you get the best credit rating, it's the easiest to borrow money. The best customer a bank has is the one that pays everything about 3 or 4 days late. So they can always charge you late interest. You know, if you're late with your credit card payment, I was late this month. Like an idiot, I had it sitting there, I had loads of other stuff to do. I think, I must pay that. By the time I got round to it, it was the day after it was supposed to have arrived. Swines. So then I get charged by Barclaycard. You know, there's an interest charge, there's a late payment charge, and it's like, I always pay it off every month. You know, and this month I was just a day late and actually getting off to them. That I suddenly become the perfect customer, because I've actually paid off what I owe them, but I've also paid them a charge on top. Yeah. That's their profit. The bad customers are the ones that pay off everything all the time in an era of so-called free banking. It's very difficult to make a profit out of you. They get to invest the money you've deposited with them, but beyond that, you're fairly useless. The other kind of bad customer is the one that never, ever, ever pays, but that's the other end of the spectrum. Yeah? Or chemistry students, I think so. The best customer is the one in the middle, the one who's late, who suffers all these charges. That's where the profits are, 2.56 billion of them in 2006. So this is why the banks have been really, you know, upset about all of this. I mean, it seems like absolute chicken feed compared to how much we have all collectively lent them in the meantime. 60 billion quid! The government lent HBOS and which other one was it? I've got blind to my blank name. Two of the banks got lent £60 billion in the aggregate, which we weren't told about, in the middle of all that financial crisis. And Mervyn Davies, the governor of the Bank of England, was in front of one of the select committees, I think the Treasury Select Committee in the week. And one of the MPs kept asking, why did you lend this money? Why weren't we told? Do you undertake? You'll tell us in the future. He said, I don't know why you keep harping on about this. Because it's 60 billion quid. So no, with you. And his basic defence was, well, they paid it back. Yeah, but what if they hadn't? What the hell would have happened next? Quite remarkable. One of the things we'll discuss is just useful because this will all still be on, you'll be able to get this on iPlayer and probably all those kind of things if today in Parliament when I addressed this, which was a couple of days ago that Mervyn Davies was there. You've got to find this stuff on Google while it's still around at the minute, although we'll talk about it later on. As lender of last resort, the Bank of England doesn't really have legal powers properly as to what it can do and doesn't have legal duties as to what it can't do. Instead, as a lender of last resort, you just assume your central bank is going to wade in and solve everything. So they just decided, let's lend 60 billion quid to these banks. Let's not tell anybody else, because otherwise their shares will plummet and the whole financial system will collapse. So what Mervyn King is saying, well, we lent the money, they paid it back, it's all right, and we're telling you about it now because it's all okay. But somebody telling you had a really scary drive, you almost came off the road, it's all right now, you know. If you'd rung your mum in the middle, she'd have died. It's the same kind of idea. And what's slightly concerning is, well, on what basis is the Bank of England lending our 60 billion quid to these banks? Because the other analysis is, well, let them crash. We're never going to solve this banking system until some of these go under, in a Lehman kind of way, and kind of wake the others up. And of course, in terms of HBOS, for example, in this situation, Lloyds, of course, were about to take them over, and were in negotiations about taking them over. And Lloyds shareholders had no idea that HBOS had such a huge hole in their accounts that they needed to be lent about half of this 60 billion quid. That's the kind of thing you want to know as a shareholder if you're voting on a takeover. So it'd be interesting to see if anyone, you know, makes more of, in a litigious way, this idea that the government of the Bank of England maybe should have made this kind of stuff public, knowing that there's potentially a huge loss now that all those Lloyds shareholders are suffering at the minute in the pain of taking over HBOS when it's almost dissolved. It's been a fascinating week just for what's been going on in the background of the financial crisis and this decision coming out as well. You can sense the palpable disappointment in the newspapers when what happens is we get this decision in the House of Lords. Same case, Office of Fair Trading and Abbey National. You can get it off if you just put Supreme Court decisions into Google. This will come up. Presumably if you're doing that in the UK, it comes up first. And the Office of Fair Trading against Abbey National and others. Lord Walker gives the leading speech with which most of their lordships concur later on, and her ladyship, Lady Hale. She's become a lady, she was a baroness. I don't know if there's any significance in that. It sounds very tedious and medieval. And we've heard of all the law firms that are involved. Asher, Simmons, Adelshaw, Goddard, Allen & Overy, Freshfields, Lovells. All these high street firms finally getting their moment. 45 billion QCs. I mean, this probably cost more than the 2.56 billion that was at stake. The basic approach from Lord Walker, who doesn't spend very long on Anthony Carkmaster Rolls's judgment, instead they spend their time talking about Mr. Justice Smith at first instance. Very long judgment, but very good on the various bits of legislation and where it comes from. And he's the one that tries to argue, you know, first instance, well, we should be able to rule that these charges are unfair. They kind of ignore the Court of Appeal, which I think is fun. I think the argument in the Court of Appeal is so transparently, this is the conclusion we want to get to. So I think the rationale is a bit thin in between times. This is fun, just on the crisis. Lord Walker, this is paragraph 2 of the judgment. I'll zoom in. Some would regard the United Kingdom system as being, in some sense at least, obviously unfair. Yeah? The fact that banks charge charges to the likes of you and I. Though Mr. Sumption QC, who appeared for the banks, he must be about a billion years old, Sumption, he's been around for decades. He's always in these big cases. Vigorously disputed Lord Mance's suggestion that his clients were engaged in a sort of reverse Robin Hood exercise. I like that. Robbing from the poor to give to the rich. This is an imponderable question, which depends partly on whether one's perception of the average customer who incurs unauthorised overdraft charges is that he is spendthrift and improvident, or that she is disadvantaged and finding it hard to make ends meet. But it is not the question for the court. I'm suddenly fascinated by the gendered writing in that sentence. Can we just spend a second on that? Apart from the reverse Robin Hood, which sounds hugely entertaining, I'd love to see a reverse Robin Hood. There is an imponderable question which depends partly on whether one's perception of the average customer who incurs or authorised overdraft charges is that he is spendthrift and improvident, so that's men, spendthrift and improvident, or that she is disadvantaged and finding it hard to make ends meet. So if you're hard up, you're a woman. If you're spendthrift and improvident, you're a man. That's just mildly fascinating. Anyway, there we are. If anyone's doing jurisprudence with Jill Marshall and that kind of bit, just bring that to her attention. She'll love that sentence. I will as soon as I see her next. But it's not a question for the court. So very clearly, this is what everyone in the world is waiting for this judgment for. You know, we're waiting for a comment about banks being awful and evil, and Lady Hale mentions some of those ideas later on. But that's not what we're deciding. And the basic answer to the question which the Supreme Court comes up with is that looking at Regulation 5 and Regulation 6, clearly for the bank certainly, charging overdraft charges and so on and so forth, bank charges generally, is part of the core bit of the deal. It's almost the whole point of the deal for the banks. And so paragraph 24 and on, they go on the various charges, the various banks' charges, a huge schedule to the judgment if you want to read about the all of that, the charges in general. So the question is, what's core and what's essential? And their lordships, this is Lord Walker in paragraph 31, says that all the expressions should be given their natural meaning. So giving this their natural meaning, you know, this is thought to be ordinarily a part of the terms of the agreement. So I've only had this for about an hour and a half, because I couldn't download it last night, annoyingly. Lots of things we can't really differentiate. Paragraph 40. There's no principal basis on which the court could decide that some services are more essential to the contract than others. In other words, it's not possible to say the clause in there that relates to you have to pay bank charges is more or less important than the others. So there's no reason, looking at this contract, why we should infer that that is somehow supposed to be collateral or less important than the rest. Looking at the contract, there's just no reason to suppose that. And I think unless, like Anthony Cardmaster Rolls, you're looking for that, I just don't think it's there. So the earlier House of Lords decision in First National Bank, Lord Steyne indicated that what is now Regulation 6.2 should be construed restrictively, and Lord Bingham said it should be limited to terms falling squarely within it. I respectfully agree. So they're just not going to expand all of this to find that some terms are less important than others, which is what the customer's argument required. So we get, at the end of Lord Walker's speech, I think with which all of their lordships concur, I would declare that the bank charges levied on personal current account customers in respect of unauthorised overdrafts, including unpaid item charges and other relevant charges, constitute part of the price or remuneration for the banking services provided. And insofar as the terms giving rise to the charges are in plain, intelligible language, no assessment under the Unfair Terms and Consumer Contracts Regulations of the fairness of those terms may relate to their adequacy as against the services supplied. So, to put that briefly, as long as they're in plain, intelligible language as the regulations provide, they are part of the price or remuneration. In other words, having to pay these charges is the cost you pay for a bank providing you with a service where they clear your checks even when you've got no money in your account. Effectively, you're getting that as a service, and that's the price you pay. An arm and a leg, you know, over and above. Something that you get from a lot of their lordships, and this I think is interesting, we'll come back to this in paragraph 52, we're going to look at banking regulation later in the year, is just thinking, well, what do we do about this? Are we just saying this is all right? If the Court of Analysis appeal, the outcome may cause great disappointment and indeed dismay to a very large number of bank customers. You feel that they have been subjected to unfairly high charges in respect of unauthorised overdrafts. But this decision is not the end of the matter, as Lord Phillips explains in the judgment. However, ministers and Parliament may wish to consider the matter further. They decided, in an era of so-called light touch regulation, to transpose the directive as it stood, rather than to confer the higher degree of consumer protection afforded by the national laws of some other member states. Parliament may wish to consider whether to revisit that decision. In other words, if you remember, we've discussed EU directives before. It would have been open to Parliament to gold plate this directive. They could have decided to make consumer protection at a higher level. They could have decided to put in provisions so that the courts could rewrite these kind of bank charges. But what they did was effectively to copy and paste the European directive. And the good European citizens, obviously, the UK is. That's why we joined the Eurozone and all that other kind of thing. Oh, I know one dares have a referendum here. We've just copied and pasted the regulations in, and that's why they're as restrictive as they are. So, basically, we're calling on Parliament to do something about it. Lady Hale's is something very similar. Let's find Lady Hale. I'll leave that one up so you can read it. Come on. Lord Phillips. I mean, why she's not a baroness anymore, I don't know. Lady Hale, I agree with Lord Walker and Lord Mance. I would only add that, and this is going to be fun when it comes to banking regulation later on as well as this bit of course, I would only add that, should this or any other parliament be minded to take up the invitation given in that paragraph of Lord Walker's judgment, it may not be easy to find a satisfactory solution. The banks may not be the most popular institutions in the country at present, slightly behind estate agents and child murderers, but that does not mean that their methods of charging for retail banking services are necessarily unfair when viewed as a whole. As opposed to the hole in which all our money's gone. As a very general proposition, consumer law in this country aims to give the consumer an informed choice rather than to protect the consumer from making an unwise choice. So her position is this is all about free markets. Yeah? You're given information, you make your mind up. We buy all sorts of products which a sensible person might not buy. I think this is a light on maybe Hale's life, is it, possibly? We buy all sorts of products which a sensible person might not buy, some of which are not good value for the money. We do so with our eyes open because we want the product in question more than we want the money. Should financial services be treated differently from other goods and services? Or is the real problem that we do not have a real choice because the suppliers all offer much the same product and do not compete on some of their terms? That's fun for those of you doing competition, it's always the unanswered question. You know, what happens when in the marketplace everyone does the same thing, even if you can't prove the cartel? You know, how do we go further and make it a proper market? If there's only Tesco and Sainsbury's left selling everything in the world, what do we do? Now, this is the situation here. But it's not clear to me whether the proper solution is to find some way of forcing the suppliers to compete with one another in the terms they offer, or whether the solution is to condemn one particular model of charging for those services. Fortunately, however, that is for Parliament and not for this court. So there's a fun overlap there between regulation, if you like, and ordinary contract law. Contract law is all about freedom of contract, it's all about open markets. And effectively, Hale is saying, look, you can't expect the courts to keep answering all these questions and sorting this out for you. If you want to deal with the banks, you're going to have to legislate for it. Legislate slash regulate. So I think that's a fun one for when we come back later in the year. What's the things we could do? We could get back the old law on usury. That'd be fun.
In the Bible and all kinds of other places, it's a sin to charge usurious rates of interest.
Usury is a mortal sin. You simply charge someone too much money, by way of interest for money you've lent them, then it'd be sin in itself. There were lots of old laws on usury. Back into the 17th century, which made it very difficult for bankers to charge high rates of interest. And those laws were eventually repealed. That, if you read Professor Atiyah's book, The Rise and Fall of the Freedom of Contract, he pinpoints as being one of the points in time when English contract law suddenly realised, yes, it should be about freedom of contract. Because historically, we weren't. There were lots of restrictions on what you could and couldn't charge in various places. The Consumer Credit Act has stuff about exorbitant credit bargains. You've done that? We did mortgages Real Property 1. I mean, we can, unpick exorbitant credit bargains. One thing we could do, which is kind of extend that idea in relation to bank charges, which is decide what we think is exorbitant. Yeah? Just pick a number. Now, at the minute, we don't do that because we prefer free markets, but the other way of doing it is to get in there. This is the great time to do this to banks, when they've still got all our money. This is a great time to give them a kick in, because they don't argue too much. But there's lots of things we could do. I just don't think there's a parliamentary will at the minute. Instead, we're debating how much bankers should be allowed to be paid. We really have telescoped the entire argument down to how much bankers should be paid, whether they should be allowed to have large bonuses or not, as though that's going to solve the question in and of itself. So let me talk about banking regulation later on. There are lots of these kind of questions, lots of things we could do to reorganise how banks should deal with their customers, but there just doesn't seem to be political will, which is funny. When we had the whip hand there for a little while, we just didn't press home the advantage. Anyway, never mind. Okay, so that was what I wanted to say about unfair contract terms. So I think that was it. I've been sort of holding that over and holding that over desperately, waiting for that judgment to come out. Good, eh? Instead of doing it and having to do it all again. Quickly through taking security. This will take today and a bit of tomorrow. So this is page 56. So apologies for the popping. Oh, and just, you know, as a kind of a finishing contract and moving away, I mean, as you see, we haven't spent a huge amount of time in our contract law section going through the nuts and bolts of contract law and the way you did it in the first year. Reason being, you did all that in the first year, and also because we're trying to focus particularly on financial uses of contracts, okay? So we're going to come back a little bit to contract terms when we're going to do lending and loans and everything, which is going to be our next topic. But again, what we're doing in the seminar on contract law and the seminar which is going to come up on lending and so on and so forth, so your seminar 5 and 6, is giving you lots of facts, I'll say a made-up case, and the idea is you're basically going to talk for 90 minutes and work out what you think. In all those training contracts that everyone keeps coming and asking me about, I've got to demonstrate some commercial knowledge or expertise. But basically, it's that kind of stuff. We're going to kick around the way finance lawyers do these kind of things. So it's not about knowing a lot of case law. It really is about kicking around. You're asked to advise Arthur Prendergast, who's entered into a contract, perhaps unwisely, with Sword Blade Bank. And there's a huge amount of PK in there, you know, that one case we spent a lot of time on. Huge amount of conduct of business. You know, what should the bank have done? How did they treat him? So you're given correspondence between the parties, made up. You're given transcripts of telephone conversations, email traffic between them, the marketing literature that the bank gave, the marketing literature that it turned into later on. And you're basically just supposed to kick around and advise. And PK is the best template for what are the common law questions, but then also in the light of conduct of business, how should that be dealt with? So the idea is just allow you to kick around and play. So it's not going over contract law in the sense of going through each case by case. There have been comparatively few that we've really focused on. Just a few that I keep kind of mentioning, like Bankers Trust and Damala are well worth the read, and obviously PK itself, Clue, well worth the read as well. Okay, and then the one you get on lending transactions also gives you a very, very outlined kind of set of accounts over 5 or 6 years and a projection for the future for a company. Tells you what their business is, gives you some made-up press articles about where this made-up company might go in the future, and says if you're about to lend this company some money, what are the sorts of things you would like to put in the contract? So it's not about contract law in that sense. It's about common sense, the things we're going to start to do in next week's lectures, which is to look at, in a lending transaction, what are the sorts of covenants you'll put in the agreement. Okay? So it's meant to be kicking around commercially. What do you think? Johnny Good. So I said to Magnus, basically she gets an hour and a half off in each seminar. She just sit there and referee and make sure no one actually kills anyone else. Yeah? That's the idea. So she's supposed to, you know, there's not meant to be answers to all of that. The whole point is there aren't. It's meant for you to decide what, how would you structure it, what do you reckon? Practice for those training contracting fields. Yeah? For those jobs that nobody has anymore. I know, it's a terrible thing. Okay, so taking security. Sorry, on to that. Taking security is something which we're not examining, we're not assessing in that way. It's a very important part of finance in practice. Okay, knowing how to take security, even if a lot of, I think, banking lawyers don't know much about it. So what I want to do is to kind of outline it today. A lot of this will be familiar, and then we'll pick through it in a bit more detail in tomorrow's lecture, and I'll be able to introduce lending in tomorrow's lecture as well. Taking security is all about how do you protect yourself in a financial transaction. Principally, how do you guard against your counterparty's insolvency? When I talk about counterparty, I simply mean that's an ugly market usage of the other person to the contract you're involved in, yeah. Your counterparty. And so, chapter 23 in the book, a lot of this hopefully will be familiar from Property 2. It should be familiar from other bits of studying property law as well. Let's just go through and work out what some of these ideas are, and I say we'll pick through the details of the quotes in more detail tomorrow. Heading 8.1, one way in which you can obviously take security is to say, you owe me an amount of money, I want you to give me some property equal to what you owe me. Equal in value to what you owe me, that's probably the word I needed in there. In other words, transfer me outright. Property of the same value as what I am owed. It may be that if you're two parties and you have a number of transactions outstanding between you, that what you will do is you will say X and Y, X owes
two payments of 100 to Y, and Y owes one payment reciprocally to X.
Put crudely in derivatives contracts, what happens in the world, a process known as collateralization, is that we decide at the end of every business day who owes what to whom on a net basis across all their transactions. So let's assume these deals are identical types of transaction, all in the same currency, nothing weird about them, all equal to 100. We decide that at the end of this day, X owes 100 to Y on a net basis. Yeah. And what collateral agreements provide is that, let's have another colour.
X has got to put aside an amount of 100.
So equal to the exposure on that day. So Y can have recourse to that money. Now, those of you that have done Property 2 and those of you that are doing Property 2 will suddenly be thinking, that sounds like a trust. Yeah, heading 8.2. That sounds like what we're saying is X is giving money to Z, 100 at the end of that particular day, so that Z will hold that on trust. All right, Z up there, is that better? From the back cranny, I'm writing it too late. Z holds that 100 on trust for Y. However, if X actually does pay the 100 it owes, then this equitable interest reverts to X instead. Okay. That's how we do this using a trust. What financial markets have actually started to do, however, is to say, instead of having a trust, because that requires us to identify someone that's got to act as trustee, someone's got to maintain that trust fund, ensure it's segregated into all those kind of other trust things, why don't we just, at the end of this business day, decide that X owes across all the transactions, and of course in the real world there'll be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. Let's just have X pay an amount equal to 100 at the end of that day. Let's call that our collateral. Because what's going on out in the world, remember those interest rate swaps we talked about last time and how all the interest rate swaps we've studied have lasted for 10 years? What the parties are doing at the end of every day is looking at, for example, their interest rate swaps and saying, well, the value of that interest rate swap today, even though it doesn't finish for another 10 years, taken at a market value today, it seems that if we had to close all this today, X would owe 200 to Y and Y would owe 100 to X. So you keep a kind of running tally going at the end of every day, what's known as marking to market. This is a huge part of the financial crisis, I think. Not discussed enough yet. You keep a running tally going across all of your hundreds and hundreds of interest rate swaps that are done for your London office denominated in sterling, for example. You decide what the net basis is at the end of each day. By measuring it, by marking it to market, measuring it against its market value on that particular business day. Now, clearly, that will go up and down. So the same transaction will be measured at, well, you owe us 100 today, but if the market goes up tomorrow, you might owe us 120 instead. At which point, we're all thinking, well, why on earth, if X owes these payments of 200 and Y owes that payment of 100, why is X agreeing to pay over 100 today? Because it's still going to have to pay over the amount under the black line, as well as this kind of net payment under the red. The answer is an EU directive. It's the EU Collateral Directive 2002, which again, something we'll talk about in new derivatives later in the year, which says that the banks are allowed to treat all of these transactions as having been set off. Why on earth does that matter? When we come to do banking regulation in more detail, we'll see that banks' principal regulatory obligation, ordinary banks, is to put aside an amount of capital to cover a percentage of their total exposure to the world. The theory being, if banks are required to put aside an amount of capital and hold that separately, then if they do fail, there will be some capital there which can be used to pay off their creditors or keep the business going, or whatever it is. Okay. Capital adequacy regulations is often referred to. And we'll talk about this in detail when we do banking regulation. The fun thing about this is, anything which is subject to one of these collateral transactions, the EU directive says, doesn't have to be included in the amount of capital you've got to put aside. So banks are very, very keen on putting these kind of arrangements in place. Because when you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of these transactions, so hundreds of millions of dollars worth of this kind of business on your books, instead of having to put tens of millions of dollars aside in capital to hold so-called regulatory capital to keep your regulator happy, you don't have to put that capital aside because you've got a contract that says we will pay this net amount at the end of every business day. And if it turns out that the transactions go the other way and actually they fall in value, then Y will pay an amount to X. Everybody's happy because that's an amount of exposure they don't have to cover by putting capital aside. And if the capital isn't put aside, you can invest it. You can make money out of it. So banks really like this stuff. So intuitively to us, it looks like X is paying twice to Y, and X is just wasting money. What on earth are they doing this for? Answer, there's a lot built out the back. And this is just another example of how bankers think in terms of numbers rather than thinking how lawyers think. So I think, am I right? Our kind of legal instinct is, why on earth is X paying this red line as well as paying all the black ones as well? Aren't you just paying an extra 100? Well, the answer is you're able to manipulate those figures across the whole of your bank's balance sheet and satisfy your regulators. And so this putting aside regulatory capital is one of the debates that's going on about banking regulation. Should we make banks put more money aside? And the banks are squealing, God, don't make us put more aside. We're going to have even less money available to invest. The market-to-market problem became a real issue in the financial crisis because as soon as nobody is dealing with one another, there stops being a market. And it's absolutely impossible for you to work out what the market value of your transactions is. So when you're trying to work out how much capital collateral to put aside during the financial crisis, God knows, nobody knew what the market value was because nobody was trading. So you had no idea how much you should put aside. Should you put aside, an amount equal to that? Should you put aside billions? We had no idea. So this theory only worked while the markets were flowing. And that's another important point about being a lawyer in these things. Guarding against these things, talking about taking security, is about thinking the unthinkable a lot of the time. Because I always advocated, settle money on trust instead. Because the risk is here, if Y goes into insolvency, and this we're doing heading, what was it, 8.1 on the handout? We're saying that X is transferring rights right the way across to Y. That satisfies Y, because Y is nice and protected. But if Y goes into insolvency, if Y is Lehman Brothers, and then becomes known as YOYOY, but then on that basis, we suddenly start thinking, well, hang on, X has now paid a huge amount across to Y and has owed a huge amount back. From a lawyer's perspective, what I want to do is say to X, don't give all that money away to Y. Let's rub out that red line. Instead, have the money settled on trust. Use Z as your trustee. And then even if Y does go into insolvency, that money is held separately on trust. The one thing we know about trust is they're immune to insolvency, yes? So your proprietary rights will subsist. I find that word difficult to say. Often a lawyer's answer, and this is just very unpopular in the markets, because everyone thought, oh, this is complicated. Oh, equitable interest, I didn't go to those seminars. How are we going to maintain that? Oh, who's going to be the trustee? Oh, it's going to be such a fag. The operations area are going to have to set up a new account. And that's bankers' basic reaction to, let's not do a trust. Morgan Guaranty do those, we don't. Do they work under French law, all that kind of stuff. Whereas instead they were paying the money over outright under collateral transactions, which is what everyone does in derivatives in all those markets, that went horribly wrong. When the other side, Lehman Brothers, goes bankrupt, they have your money. You've transferred it to them outright. So it's basic lawyer stuff. It really is just assessing what you think the risks are. There we go. I think we're at time. That'll do for the day. That's puncturing the meaning of taking security. The real message there is it's always that problem of language again. The way bankers talk, the way lawyers think about the same deals.